Madman joined your channel.
Show number 426 for Thursday, February the 25th, 1848. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and Madman, were you cooking an entire fleet of rotisserie chickens?
They're called flocks, not fleets. Fleets are what I used to shoot them down with.
Fair enough. And RU is here.
What's up, man? Another week? I thought I lost 3 days at one point this morning. It's amazing how one day out of your calendar is thrown off. It just can ruin your whole week.
I love it when you wake up, you look outside, it's dark, you look at the clock and it's 3 a.m, and you don't know what year it is. That's happened to me more than once this week, actually.
The whole working from home thing will do that to you.
Yeah.
Like a weekend doesn't mean shit anymore, right? It's not like you can go anywhere anyway.
Well, it does a little bit. It means I don't have to log into the chat room and wait for somebody to scream at me about a setup being wrong. Oh my God. Yeah, I tell you what, if you work for a large organization, and you think that you can hop into the incorrect channels to ask for a back channel to IT because you're not getting the response you want from the other teams, asking the security team and their back channel because somebody let you into it because it was an emergency to go fix your settings because you don't want to wait on the help desk is not going to win you any friends.
But dick and a half move.
I'm not bitter. Not at all. I did post in there that, you know, posting this kind of stuff in the wrong channel just makes it confusing and doesn't really help. And the response I got was, oh, I need a back channel. Well, you're not going to get it. That's not how any of this works. For anyone who doesn't get what I'm on about, most management in IT is about tracking and controlling work. And people trying to establish back channels so that they could just call their favorite IT person to get what they want, it leads to problems. That's actually something I've been trying to fight against for years. My current company is trying to get people to stop going to their favorite IT guy to get the changes they want done because... you know, they had all these out-of-band changes. And you say, why didn't you do the stuff you were supposed to do? Well, I had to do this, this, and this because all these VPs kept calling me. Send them to your boss. Well, it's a VP. I don't care if it's the president of the fucking company. They open a ticket, and they wait in queue just like everybody else. Because otherwise, you will never get anything done.
That's it.
Makes me really glad I'm not on the help desk anymore. Let me put it that way. I've done my time on the help desk.
Being in the trenches. I could not do it, man. I just don't have the people skills.
I spent about a year and a half on the help desk. I did my time as a sysop. I have done my time as a sim monkey. I have done my time running antivirus servers. Email security is the worst thing in the world. I'm just going to say it right now. And there are people who will go into their spam box, whitelist every email address that was in their spam box because it could be important, and click on every fucking link and type their password into every fucking page.
But it said I want a free iPhone.
It lied.
The internet doesn't lie. Brings me video games and movies and free porn.
Well, you punch your credit card in there and let me know when you get that free iPhone. why did somebody steal all my money? Because you're an idiot.
Oh, no, I just wanted my business passwords. I didn't want any of my stuff. My stuff's valuable.
You have no idea how true that statement is, Madman. But enough about my day. How's your job going, Madman?
I made one nice old lady's day. I found documents that had nothing to do with my bank or about a mortgage loan that had nothing to do with anything that I ever touched. All because she kept getting the runaround from three different companies.
But I actually like what you do, Madman. You actually put effort in to help people when they're at least decent to you.
Oh, yeah. If she was, wasn't a confused, nice old lady, I'd have been like, this has nothing to do with the business, the company that I work for. I don't even know how you got routed to me. Actually, I do know how. It's because the servicing department didn't want to talk to her anymore, and she said the word release. So they got routed to the first person that answered the phone, and unfortunately, it was me. But it was a nice lady, and the state that she lived in had easy enough access records that I was able to track down what she needed and then told her what to tell her title company and then emailed it to her.
There you go. If you want to do something nice with this weekend, Doc's Madman, find out where he works and send a nice letter to his boss saying how good of a person he is.
And that Madman knows the magic numshubs to give the financial industry to make mortgage people do the right thing. So are you, how's your, I know better than that. Never mind.
My hustle's going quite well, man. It's picking back up. This is a bit hard during the COVID times, but people are actually buying and selling again, so that's a good fucking deal.
So.
Not being able to move shit into states is an actual fucking pain in the ass right now.
Anyways. Oh, Madman, you got a question in the IRC there from Rats.
What's the question?
He wants to know how proud he was when he saw The Incredibles and he told the old lady the sneaky way to get around the insurance bullshit.
yeah, I like that.
So, anyways, you guys ready to move on to the stories here, or we can keep bullshitting about stuff?
I'm good. Let's get cracking.
All right. First one up is from Extreme Tech. And I remember talking about this, 3 years ago when it was in the news. John Deere fails to uphold right to repair agreement signed in 2018.
What a shock.
Was there any teeth in that agreement? I'm assuming not, since they said fuck you on it.
Surprising exactly nobody. In September 2018, the Equipment Dealers Association signed an agreement with John Deere in which the company would begin voluntarily making repair tools, software guides, and diagnostic equipment available for ordinary farmers for the purpose beginning January 1, 2020. We're now well over 2 months into 2021, and as the new report details, John Deere isn't keeping up its end of the bargain. Purpose of the agreement between John Deere and the EDA was to deal with the increasingly onerous software lockouts John Deere bakes into its tractors. Farmers have been increasingly forced to visit a John Deere dealership for even trivial repairs because once simple repairs now require dealer-authorized equipment to authenticate the hardware. The deal with the EDA took the pressure off of states to pass right to repair legislation at the time. Extreme Tech characterized it as throwing farmers under the bus because of the numerous structural deficiencies. But those deficiencies, like a failure to define the need for a fair and reasonable pricing on spare parts, or the need for the the need to be able to purchase spare parts at all are less important here. The problem isn't that John Deere has balked at implementing part of the agreement. It's that John Deere apparently hasn't lifted a finger to implement it. Both Vice and the U.S. Public Interest Research Group recently followed up with how the rollout of this new information has gone. Kevin O'Reilly of U.S. PIRG called 12 John Deere dealerships across six states. He reports of those, 11 told me they don't sell diagnostic software, and the last one gave me an email of someone to ask for the tools. Sent an email 2 days ago and haven't heard anything back. Vice then performed its own survey, calling 9 different dealerships in 7 different states outside of California and 3 inside of it. One California dealership offered to try to help with the problem. The other 2 immediately stated no such information or manuals were available. None of the other 9 had access to offer or any product to sell, nor information regarding when either would be available. According to John Deere and the Association of Equipment Manufacturers, a major industry lobbying group, there's absolutely nothing wrong. The AEM claims that comprehensive repair and diagnostic information is now available for the vast majority of tractor and combine market through authorized dealers. When U.S. PRIG asked AEM to provide even one example of a company actually making this information available, the trade group failed to respond. Yeah, no surprise there. Yeah, no, companies just say bullshit all the time, and when you call them on it, they just don't respond. I know how that goes. I deal with software vendors. Oh, yeah, we have this feature. Cool. Show me where it is in the software. And that's the end of the meeting.
Don't worry. It's going to be implemented the next update.
Yeah, Symantec.
I get that one.
My favorite was Symantec literally claiming stuff was in the software. I remoted into our management server, put it up on the projector in front of like a whole bunch of important people in the company, and be like, show me. Show me where that feature is. I would love to implement it right now. Well, I think it's in our beta test lab, which is where I saw it. Uh-huh. They then quickly ended the meeting and exited the building. And that feature never materialized. Strange. At a Right to Repair meeting with the Florida Farm Bureau, John Deere customer support manager Aaron Vance made the following public comments. Many of these manufacturers, ourselves included, we provide diagnostic tools, repair manuals, parts, diagnostic and repair information to you. The producer has always been around. You've always had parts. You've always been able to get manuals, papers, and such. You have the right to repair your own equipment. There's been very little evidence to support this claim, particularly the always had parts and the always able to get manuals portion. Vice located one farmer in Montana, Walter Schweitzer, whose dealership agreed to provide him with software equipment and training to help keep his own tractor for $8,000. His story appears to be virtually unique. There are up to 125 sensors in a John Deere tractor, and error code on any of them can put the device into limp mode, where it can be driven but not otherwise operated. It can take up to a month for a piece of equipment to get a simple error code cleared, and it can cost a great deal of money. According to Missouri farmer Jared Wilson, he lost tens of thousands of dollars in income one season because it took 32 days for a dealer to repair a mechanical valve that failed on his fertilizer spreader. He had been able to access the parts and diagnostic tools he needed, or had he been able to access the diagnostic parts and diagnostic tools he needed, he believes he would have been able to perform the work himself. Wilson reached out to ET directly and told us how he had the option to license a, quote, neutered version, unquote, of John Deere's Service Advisor software, but at $4,000 a year. It's beyond what his farm or business can afford. That's not for your, you know, onesie-twosie farmer. That's for, like, somebody running a factory farm where they're running a fleet of these things.
Yeah.
I imagine there's a hell of a business opportunity for a company to come in and start making tractors identical to how they made them in the 20s. And I mean the 1920s.
I wouldn't go quite the 1920s.
Okay, 1960s.
But maybe the early 2000s.
Well, basically devoid of most of the computing power. Just straight up mechanics and electrical. You know, easy things that anybody could work on. I bet there would be a hell of a market for that kind of thing. That
a
or
lot
you'd
of
get
farm equipment.
You'd get
a lot of farm equipment today, Morps, is set and forget. Yeah. You just put the GPS in and let it run.
Yeah, that's you're why just I was thinking early 2000s they might get away with it because didn't they have GPS?
Yeah.
I mean, it was super expensive then, but it still existed.
Well,
yeah, most of them are just pilots in there now. They don't actually do anything until something goes wrong or, you know, stop when it needs refilling or something. But even then, I think the machine stops itself and will drive back over to the shed to grab more fertilizer or whatever.
Well,
and again, I'm a long way removed from a farmer.
I'm thinking in terms of like single farms where they want to buy a piece of equipment and maintain it, not, you know.
Well, the big factory farms, they're not farmed by dozens of people. You're talking one family for hundreds of acres.
Yeah.
And the reason they want to be able to fix it themselves is the price margin on food, it's not that high. So you're talking step below wholesaler, so the cheapest rung on the sales of food, their markups are like pennies. So if they can save the equivalent of $1 an acre, that translates to millions of bucks. I don't know how many hours it takes for one of these tractors to, you know, take care of an acre off the top of my head. But just them being able to fix it could still save them tons of money, even though it's just like one family.
Well, I guess the point I'm getting at here is if you were to go to these farmers and say, I'll sell you a tractor that you can repair versus what John Deere is doing, you would think they would eat John Deere's lunch.
Except oh, yeah.
I'm sure there's hundreds of other things you have to get right to build a tractor other than just saying, yeah, we're going to make it repairable. But I'm just kind of surprised you don't have anybody doing that because, I mean, we've been talking about tractors being a major source of, things that people can't fix for 4 years now.
Dude, I remember doing the story when they won the right to repair.
Yeah.
Caterpillar's one of the newer heavy industrial manufacturers in the U.S., and the head of Caterpillar has said he could not start his business today with all the regulations in place to actually run his business. We're regulating innovators out of the market. John Deere doesn't care because they're already here.
Yeah.
But Badman, super awesome tractor, beer, and pizza, never going to get started up because of that tractor part of it.
Good luck getting the beer and pizza off the ground, too.
Oh, no. Thank you, Jimmy Carter. Because of him, I could get the beer part off the ground.
Okay, so it's pretty easy to open a liquor store?
No, it's pretty easy to open a brewery now.
Okay.
But packaged liquor, you're going to have to come in and get your beer for a while. I'll have to find distributors.
I would say that's what the internet for, but liquor is one of the few things that's actually hard to sell over the internet.
Oh, no, I have to go through a licensed distributor where I live.
Yeah,
there are two of them.
I know there's like wine clubs and stuff like that, but you still usually have to go pick them up somewhere through a distributor, or sometimes you can get them mailed. I don't know what the difference
That's
is.
That's actually loosening up.
But now, I know liquors and beers, for the most part, you can't.
And it kind of varies from state to state on where those places can deliver, because the licensing is different. But I think John Deere, they need to look at that agreement, and apparently they didn't put any teeth in it because John Deere's ignoring it. Any agreement must be enforceable, or it's not an agreement.
Well, and the thing is, you do end up in this kind of a weird limbo where you need John Deere to provide replacement parts, manuals, and software to other people to be able to repair their stuff. And I'd kind of like to think, I bought the tractor, I should get the support information for the tractor. But at the same time, you could easily come at it from John Deere's side and say, well, they're requiring us to manufacture a bunch of products that aren't part of our core business. We're not a tech support company. We sell tractors. But, I mean, I could see both sides of that argument. I tend to fall on the right to repair. But I also think most things should be open source these days, so.
Well, they're not producing anything new, though. The tools already exist. They're just being given to their dealerships, and their dealerships are the only ones allowed to have them because of John Deere saying, we're only giving this to our dealerships. So they're not building anything new. They're just not selling what they've built to other people to compete with.
Well, and two, I'm wondering if you did try to start up a competing tractor company, if they would sue the oblivion out of you saying, oh, you're violating patents and copyright and 100 other things just because you made a tractor, you know?
I wonder how much of this we need to reform our patent system. Now, I do think you should have a patent for a little while, but how many years should you have exclusive rights to something before it goes open source?
Well, I think the original, what was it, 12 years?
Yeah, I think it was fine. Like 10 or 12.
I mean, you think about it now, oh, you're using a 12-year-old computer? Oh. Although, I guess people still drive 12-year-old cars. My car's like 10, so. Yeah. No, is it that old? Yeah, it's that old.
And a 10-year-old tractor, the last time I looked at anything as far as cutting-edge farming was in college, and I went to an orchard that had the programmable tractor. It went around, planted how much ever stuff, came back around, and did precision spraying. So at that point, almost everything on that machine would be open source now.
Yeah.
You'd be able to maintain it yourself. So you might not be able to stay super cutting edge, but you can stay close enough to be profitable.
See, because I don't know that you should have to require John Deere to release their diagnostic software, right? But I do think that to interface with the system, to be able to throw commands at it, clear out error codes, shit like that, that ought to be open source. And then if I can find stuff online where somebody's writing their own software to interface with the thing, that shouldn't be illegal. But, you know, we did the story, I want to say 2 years ago, where there was a group that was hacking these tractors so that they could, you know, clear error codes and fix them themselves, and John Deere was trying to sue them. So that's the part I don't like, is this whole, you know, even the interface is locked down. I don't care if you don't want to publish your diagnostic software. I mean, I get it. I think you probably should, because you're selling a piece of industrial equipment, and your source of profit should be selling the equipment, not locking down its repair. But and it's like, well, you don't want to, sell the repair parts, fine. At least put out a manual with the technical drawing, so if somebody wants to get something CNC'd, they can, you know? As it is right now, if somebody doesn't reverse engineer a part or, you know, take their tractor apart and measure everything and make their own CAD, I mean, you know, because I don't want to require John Deere to sell a part unless they've, you know, obviously signed a contract saying they're going to support something for so long. But, you know, if they don't want to sell spare parts, fine, at least publish the specs so somebody else could make them if they needed them, you know? Especially if it is a mechanical part, because my understanding of the law is you can't really copyright anything that's purely a mechanical part. You can patent it, but I think patents still expire. I don't think patents have had their expiry length extended, have they? I know copyright is ridiculous. It's like life of the creator plus however long Mickey Mouse has existed.
Exactly.
But I don't think patents have been stretched out quite so bad. Now, the patent office is letting people patent damn near anything, and software patents probably really shouldn't be a thing. But I don't know. Yeah, Rats is saying death plus 70 years. You watch the next time Mickey Mouse comes up, you know, for that death plus 70 years, it'll be death plus 120.
Oh, that is retarded.
It every time it's Disney lobbying it every fucking time. Oh, Rats is saying patent is 14 years. That's okay. That's fair. I think that's a fair length of time, because a 14-year-old piece of technology is not going to be cutting edge, it's not going to be modern, but it probably will work. you know, if we all had to live on Commodore 64s, the internet wouldn't be nearly as
perfect. World.
I would be happy. I wouldn't have a job, but I'd be happy. But you know, the internet would be a lot less interesting and be a lot more text based. But
you're thinking,
you could do it.
14 years ago from now, 2006.
I can live with XP.
Yeah.
2007. You had GUIs, you had video. I think we were watching Mystery Men on computers, on floppy disks.
That might have been a thing.
I don't think I want to go back to the racks of CDs, though, and DVDs.
Oh, DivX. I can live with that. I still got a spindle somewhere around here.
My cupboard's full of them.
Rats is saying, apparently Tom Scott made a video saying a copyright should be creation plus 50 years.
Oh, no.
I mean, just 50 years from creation.
Oh, just 50 years from creation? I could see that.
I mean, I don't know. I'd have to watch the video to see what arguments he's making. Wasn't original copyright pretty similar to patents? It was like 20 years or something like that. It wasn't this inordinate amount of time.
Yeah, I think it was crazy when it went to life of author.
Yeah. I mean, you think about, and of course this was a big thing a few years back. People were talking about the remix culture and things like that, but I, you know, having stuff be locked up under copyright for so long that it's like, well, did you record it off a gramophone? Okay, now it's okay to use for something, is technically impossible to enforce, for one thing, just because so many people will just take whatever and, you know, go through modern popular music and see if you can identify all the samples and what they're from, and go. Because, I mean, it's just not going to happen. But, you know, so practicality needs to take in at some point. But there's a whole bunch of stuff that people don't know if it's copywritten or public domain just because they can't figure out who owns it, but it's not old enough to automatically be public domain. And I think it would be interesting to see what would happen if, you know, 50 years, so anything from the 60s back in the public domain, just to see what you'd get out of that, especially in the internet. But I don't know, man. I don't.
Not something I've put a lot of thought into, to be honest.
Yeah, it's just one of these things where, on one hand, I certainly appreciate a company needing to protect their creation so that they can turn a profit. And I don't have a major problem with that in concept. But what I don't like is this company, you know, once they sell it to you, it's now yours, not theirs anymore. I don't like the idea of the company saying, well, we're going to sell this to you, but you can't do this, you can't do that. It's like, no, once it's mine, I can do whatever the hell I want with it. And this whole locking it down to you can only get it repaired by them, and you can only interact with it with their software, but they're not going to make the software available. And if you make your own interface, we'll sue you into oblivion. I don't like that. I feel like that's just locking things down and, well, stifling innovation. So
I think instead of making an agreement with the trade group, the farmers need to get together and make the agreement themselves with John Deere.
Yeah. Or, you know, buy tractors from somebody who'll let you fix them. That's, you know, whole free market thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
Question is finding one that will do that.
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, how much, as much as we're griping about it, how much is this actually hurting John Deere's business? Probably not that much if they're ignoring it.
Yeah.
Well, how big of a lock do they have? The question is, how easy is it to import a tractor from somewhere else? And then once it's imported, is it as easy to get fixed? Because that's the problem that farmers are trying to get around. They can import an open source tractor from Taiwan as an example, but if they can't get the parts here, what's the use of having the open source tractor?
Well, if you have the open source tractor, the specs for the parts in a CNC.
Good luck having pricing the one-time part from any metal fabricator.
Yeah, that's a good point.
For it to be truly cost-effective, you would need to have a company that's devoted itself to making spare parts. Or just John Deere supplying spare parts and not charging for installation. Just like you can go buy a part.
Well, you know, a few years back, I managed to crunch one of my rear headlights or one of the signal lights on my car. And it's a Ford. And they did not want to sell me that part. Now, I eventually got them to do it. But, and I swapped it myself, and it wasn't a hard swap, right? It's a fucking taillight. It's, you know, you pop the old one out, you unhook the wire harness, you hook the wire harness onto the new one, you shove it back in. Done. No, they did not want to sell me that part. It was an $80 part. And they wanted to, you know, they wanted me to bring it in, and they wanted to charge me $300 of labor to switch out that part. That was the estimate. It was $300 plus the part. And I'm like, I'll just do it myself. It's a tail light. And I, by, for the record, I didn't run the car into anything. I ran something into the car. It was me being dumb. It was a heavy trailer, and I thought I had control of it, and I kind of didn't. Anyways, and it was on a hill. Like I said, it was me being dumb. But, yeah, I mean, I finally got them to sell me the part, but they really didn't want to. So, I imagine that's, you know, what if I had gotten somebody who wasn't really wasn't ready to finally go, fine, I'll just sell you the part. I don't know.
Oh, it looks like it started getting bad in the 90s. I'm looking at Rat's little contribution to our discussion. This history of copyright.
Well, he's talking about how a lot of these tractors are really expensive pieces of equipment, and that, you know, you have people who aren't finding out how, you know, till later, after it's been a sunk cost for, you know, years, how expensive they are to repair. So. And he's also talking about, let's see, horror stories. If you want to change anything on a plane, an aviation inspector has to sign off on it. If you strap a fire extinguisher to the floor to meet code, you have to pay an inspector $250 an hour to sign off on it. Well, that's a, and that's a regulation problem more than, you know, just, you know, the companies that make the airplanes. But that's a, I don't know where this argument ends, though, because at some point, like with aviation, you do want some rules with, you know, what you can fly. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, maybe you don't want the backyard mechanic building a fucking B-52 and then crashing it into the, you know, the town center by accident.
And that attitude, sir, can fuck right off. I want every cunt building a plane in their backyard.
Well, and that's the argument, right? Do you want that or not? And that's, I kind of see both sides of that one too.
If I can, why can't I? You know what I mean? If I have the means and the ability and the cash to build my own fucking plane and I'm willing to risk myself in that plane, yes, this society is way too risk averse now.
But
we need to take more risks.
But and then you get into shit like, you know, like the Great Britain's planning boards where, yeah, that's your land, well, but we didn't approve you building that house, so you have to tear it down.
How did the generation who went to war and risked everything come back and turn into such the biggest fucking pussies when it comes to health and safety? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is just bullshit, man. If I want to build a fucking race car or a fucking airplane or a hovercraft, I should be able to. If I want to build my own Kalashnikov, I should be able to.
When it comes to the right to repair, I believe we all agree that once you buy something, you should be able to repair it. And we need to reduce the amount of time copyrights and patents exist.
I'm down with that.
All right. What's the next story, minutes on Marks? The first story.
Next story is from GameSpot. Metallica's BlizzCon performance is ruined by Twitch.
Isn't everything?
This is the funniest fucking shit. The Metallica performance didn't fade to black, but what happened may have been even worse. The BlizzCon veterans returned this year's only BlizzCon online festivities. So they only did BlizzCon virtually because of, you know, the virus.
Wait, you don't have a phone?
Do you guys not have phones?
Yeah.
But the thrash metal band's performance was ruined by a most unlikely culprit, Twitch. Right in the middle of one of its first songs, the audio was replaced by some easy listening bell music, presumably to avoid having Blizzard banned for a false DMCA notice.
Yes.
It's we finally come full circle.
Doing a fucking live performance for a virtual con, and the copyright bots banned them. They banned the fucking band playing their own fucking music at a performance which I assume Blizzard paid them a lot of money for, and haram. Replaced it with bell music.
Any old other music band, should be haram. I would say this sucks. But Metallica deserves it.
Fuck yes. Lars can eat my ass going after LimeWire and shit like that in Napster. Eat my ass. Fuck them.
Right now we've made fun of those losers. Let's move on.
The clip, which esports expert Rod Brusalo shared on Twitter, shows that the band rocking out with lead guitarist Kirk Hammett shredding, completely unaware that people were hearing what sounded like the main menu theme for a Teletubbies game.
Yeah.
On the plus side, that tinny snare drum couldn't be heard. Several commenters online pointed out the irony of this happening to Metallica. The band, particularly drummer Lars Ulrich, has been heavily critical of online music sharing, and the band had a high-profile case with Napster back in 2000. Still, we have to imagine the band is madly in anger with Twitch over the fiasco. The performance was one of only semi-normal BlizzCon events that could continue during the pandemic, as Blizzard has hosted other or big-name musicians for its celebrations going back to The Offspring in 2005. No one could, quote, come out and play this year, so the virtual show was all fans could get. BlizzCon continued on February 20th with additional panels. So, yeah. And the cat just tackled the window. Okay, then. Did that hurt? Cat just headbutted the window, so it's like, okay.
But anyway, it sucks shit.
Too litigious. Without a complaint, your video can be replaced.
Yeah.
Even though it's the band playing the band's music.
Now here's the question. Would Lars have come in and then demanded that Twitch pay them for the...
Oh, you no. Bet your ass, man. Here's so much money.
Here's the question. Is it actually Metallica's music?
I assume it belongs to whatever publisher they signed with.
Yeah, sometimes bands still have the right to their music. Other times it belongs to the publisher.
I'd say Metallica were clever enough to keep themselves.
Recently,
yeah.
But their early albums?
Yeah, I mean, you got to think when they're doing their early stuff, they don't know the game yet.
I mean, for a while, Michael Jackson owned the Beatles. Beatles music.
There are theories that that's why he died.
That's what caused the fallout between him and Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney was attempting to get the rights to his music back for a while. When they came up for auction, he bid on them, and he was outbid by Michael Jackson.
The hell of a cock block.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty fucked when you can't buy the rights to your own shit anymore.
Yeah, you just had to outbid Michael Jackson.
You know what, Morps? No, fuck them. If they give the rights to their music away, they've sold out. They can go fuck themselves.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, if you haven't got the integrity to believe in yourself to start with, who gives a shit? If you know you're good enough and you got record contracts coming at you, just say no. Self-produce.
Blame a lot of people whenever they're starting out, because the starving artist, it's a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason. If I'm living hand to mouth and I'm offered $3 million for my first album, I'm not gonna say I won't take it, because I might need a place to live and some food.
But your give second album, when you've known better.
Give me $200,000. If you can't live on $200,000 for 3 years to produce another album, and say, oh, I can't keep the rights, why go for the big fucking money straight away?
All right, not for the big money, but what if that's their offer, is we want the rights to this music?
No.
Because the record label, they're thinking you might be good. You might be a great artist. But are you going to sell? Because they'll finance a few hundred great artists that no one buys just for the Justin Bieber. They might find someone that everyone wants to buy, whether or not they deserve it.
God, I wish you had found a better example.
Yeah, I see your point.
I'll give you one. Have you ever heard of the Hold Steady or... Red Jumpsuit Apparatus?
Yes,
those are two different bands.
Yes, I've heard of them, but only from you.
Yeah, they're good bands. No one's heard of them. They do have records. You can buy them in record stores. But whoever put up the money for them, they're not making it back. At least not at the rate that a Metallica turns over.
Fair enough.
Next article.
Sure.
It's from Ars Technica. A failure to update critical prison management software has kept hundreds of incarcerated people in Arizona behind bars longer than they should be, according to a whistleblower report. Employees for the Arizona Department of Corrections have known about the bug since 2019, Phoenix-based NPR affiliate KJZZ reported. The flaw follows a change to state law that the software simply cannot handle and has not been updated to deal with. Arizona is one of the highest imprisonment rates in the country, with drug possession convictions being one of the highest drivers behind the numbers. An amendment to Arizona state law in June 2019 created a mechanism through which inmates convicted of certain nonviolent drug offenses can earn credits towards early release. Eligible inmates who complete a program such as GED equivalent or substance abuse treatment while imprisoned can earn 3 days credit for every 7 days served and shorten the length of time they spend behind bars to 70% of their assigned sentence. The Arizona Department of Corrections' own FAQ about the program specifies that neither inmates nor their families should contact anyone to request an eligibility review. Quote, this is done automatically based on system programming, which generates a list for time comp. The document reads, the reviews are being completed based on projected earliest release dates. According to whistleblowers, however, that system cannot identify eligible participants and does not make those calculations. Quote, we knew from day one this wasn't going to work, unquote, a source in the Department of Corrections told KJZZ. I'm really trying not to say cages. When I see that, because that's kind of what it looks like. When they approved that bill, we looked at it and said, oh shit. The whistleblower said that they had been making repeated internal warnings to the department's IT officials in 2019. KJZZ obtained a copy of an October 2020 bug report detailing how the software called ACES fails to keep up with the law. Quote, currently this calculation is not in ACES at all, unquote. The report reads, ACES can calculate one earned credit for every 6 days served, but this is a new calculation. The department confirmed to KJZZ that it is aware of the problem with ACES. Data is being calculated manually and entered into the system. Spokesperson Bill Lamar told KJZZ, stating that the department has identified 733 inmates who are eligible to take part in the early release program but are not yet enrolled. So, the article goes on, but basically, because nobody has bothered to update their custom software to match the law, there are people in jail who shouldn't be.
Now, does the law say must or may?
I think it says may.
Then it kind of sucks, but that's their way out because they're not being kept beyond their sentence. Their sentence just isn't being reduced for something that it may be reduced for, not must be reduced.
Well, and it does flat out say not to contact, you know, Department of Corrections to, with inquiries about it, that it's supposed to be automatic. So they're doing that. So, you know, you're kind of in the dark on what your credits are. But, I mean, that's kind of fucked. One, they've got a system where you should be earning more credit for your, towards your jail time than you're allowed to see, and you can't question it. But then, you can't, you know, if the software's not actually doing it, you're hoping somebody notices that you're eligible. And
yeah, sucks a little bit. But if you didn't want to get sentenced to 10 years for doing something,
probably should
either
done
get
that.
The law changed where the penalty isn't as harsh, or don't do the thing. It's not like they're keeping someone that was sentenced 10 years for 11 years. They're just keeping someone that was sentenced to 10 years, did some stuff in prison to hopefully improve his life when he gets out, and then he doesn't get released early for that. Fair, automatically.
Fair point. What were you going to say, are you?
Nothing.
Although, I do think there's one thing we should do to help out former convicts.
What's
I that? Don't think your prison record should be held against you for terms of employment.
Unless it's of a sexual nature or child.
Oh, no. I'm going to even go with that. If you cannot be reintroduced to society, then the penalty for your crime should either be life imprisonment or death. But if you're going to let somebody out and say you've served your served your debt to society, then society should bring you back into the fold. And if
yeah.
whatever reason society says you can't be brought back in the fold, then you should not be released. Your penalty, your crime is so great, you should either spend the rest of your life in prison or you should be hung by the neck until dead.
Yeah, I'm good on that one, man.
But yeah, a drug dealer, if you have a drug offense, there's a lot of companies that won't hire you. So if you can't get a job that you can sustain your life on, what are you going to do? I'm not going to starve. And if no one's going to give me a job, if there's a job available, I'll find another way to make money. And I find stealing morally wrong, but there isn't anything wrong with selling something someone wants.
Yeah. It's a product. I'll give you that. It's an easy product. It sells itself.
I mean, at that point, I'm seeing society is kind of forcing you into a no-win situation here. So, yeah, let them back in or don't let them out.
Yeah, I can get behind you on that one, Madman.
All right. Next article. This one's from 9to5mac.com. It's all over the place, though, and I'm not going to read the full story. I just, we can no longer make the joke that we used to make. Fry's Electronics is officially going out of business.
Yeah, I saw that.
It's because they didn't pay us not to try to endorse them.
Their only one and only sponsor. They didn't know that they're a sponsor.
And wouldn't pay us to stop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sad. I mean, Best Buy still does sell some electronics, but becoming less and less, and they direct you to their website.
No, it's if you want electronics these days, it's all online. Mouser, DigiKey, or AliExpress. So, it sucks, but it's the nature of things, and you know, I mean, you could argue COVID may have had something to do with it. You can argue online sales had something to do with it. It kind of makes you wonder how much of a brick and mortar for devices or for things that aren't like, you know, food is, how much of that is still a viable business?
If it's COVID, then it truly sucks, and I think it may be, because I still go to niche stores, and I see other people there. So there are communities willing to do this. Now, I don't know if Fry's will be able to keep up, 4,000 square foot. Well, actually, 4,000 isn't that big for a store. 100,000 square foot store, they might have to drop down to, 6 or 7,000 square feet. But I think there's enough people that want to buy electronics that there would still be a market for it.
I hope so. I mean, I think so too, but they're calling it quits, so I guess not enough to maintain the current model. So, next article is from Bleeping Computer. Supermarket giant Kroger has suffered a data breach after a service used to transfer files securely was hacked and threat actors stole files. Kroger is one of the largest retailers in the world, along with 2,800 stores in 35 states. Kroger's employees approximately 500,000 people and has had over $122 billion in sales for 2019. Yesterday, Kroger disclosed that they were the latest company to be affected by a security vulnerability in the Acelion FTA software that allowed hackers to steal data from companies utilizing the service. According to a data breach advisory published yesterday, Kroger was informed by Acelion of their breach on January 23rd, 2021. So one, not a terrible turnaround time on Kroger's part. They only waited a month. Rather than a quarter or even a year, like we've seen a lot of companies do, and immediately discontinued their use of the service. As part of their investigation of the attack, Kroger has determined that no grocery store data, including payment information, was impacted. However, the breach did expose human resources data and pharmacy records, which is probably what they were after in the first place.
Yep.
At this time, based on information provided by Acelion of their own and our own investigation, Kroger believes that the categories of affected data may include certain associates' HR data, certain pharmacy records, and certain money service records.
Oh, Western money Union. Transfers.
They were getting the Western Unions.
Not only just the wire transfers, but you can load certain payment devices from there.
Oh, and money orders, yeah.
Orders, the prepaid cards, and some of those prepaid cards have direct deposit options.
Yeah, at this time, based on the information provided by... Oh, I already read that. Importantly, there was no impact to grocery store data or systems, credit or debit information, or customer account passwords, Kroger explained. Kroger states they're in the process of contacting those affected by postal mail. For those affected, Kroger is offering a free year of credit monitoring. Postal mail, that's interesting. So... they're going down. They're going old school because they know there's going to be lawsuits out of this.
But not only lawsuits, but it may also be the only way they have to contact some of these people.
Oh yeah.
If you file a Western Union, they don't ask for an email address.
Yeah, they may have an address. Well, a lot of times they'll have a phone number.
Yeah.
Although, if somebody called me saying I'm from Kroger and your data has been breached, I'd laugh at them and call them a scammer. So. I mean, I've been getting 8 or 10 scam calls a day, most of them saying this is your final notice, and I really wish it was.
I hate to say it, but Postal Service, it's one of the more legits because it costs money to send something. And even that, was it now 50 cents a stamp? Something. That's a barrier to entry that reduces scam.
That's true. So... the article goes on talking about other Acelion breaches, but, they're kind of hit and miss. But basically, they got some of Kroger's pharmacy records and their HR data, so that's a problem.
I wonder if they got found out before they popped something else, because I think of Kroger's as groceries, because that's all I ever get from that company. But Kroger's is a retailer? They own jewelry stores.
Yeah, they do a lot of other stuff, but Acelion's a secure file transfer system, so it's likely they were using that to move data between other companies. So, if they got the HR data and pharmacy data and maybe some money services data, I assume that they were intercepting communications or potentially could have intercepted communications between their partner companies when they were doing things like the back-end reconciliation for money orders, Western Unions.
Or RX refills from drug suppliers.
Exactly.
Or insurance company reconciliations. Okay, yeah. So it wasn't exactly Kroger's internal, it was them. Okay.
Yeah, this is what a lot of legacy systems would call EDI, Electronic Document Interchange. So they're exchanging ledgers that would then get processed by the whatever the other company's system was and integrated into their systems to acknowledge whatever has happened. So, and it's just interesting, but I'd hate to be that Excellion company right now, because they're really not looking good, and their company is probably done, because I imagine everybody doing business with them is looking to get out. All right, last article and I have for go ahead.
One comment on that is that could actually be a bad thing when it comes to this industry. It gives you less incentive to be straightforward with your customers. If you know you're going down once a breach like this happens, even if you do everything to correct it and fix it going forward.
No, this is where you see the executives sell all their stock and make a run for it. I mean, you know, that actually happened with Equifax, where they had a couple of executives they were investigating later because they happened to sell all of their stock right before that announcement came out. So,
oh, Equifax, you'll fucking die in a fire. I hate any company that I don't choose to do business with, but I have to do business with. Fuck them.
Next article. Last article is from Vice. And this one's a doozy. I don't know what to make of this one. So I'm just going to read it. I'm going to try my best to read it straight. We're just going to read it. Internet occultists are trying to change reality with a magical algorithm. And yes, they spelled magic with a K.
Virtual adepts of the world unite?
No, this looks like Order of Hermes trying to figure out how to use laptops.
That actually exists as a subset of that group. I kind of want to play one now.
The Sigil Engine adapts an ancient practice for the internet age, creating mystic symbols that true believers say can bend the universe to their will. Actually, this is almost verbania, except instead of blood, they're using JPEGs. For anybody wondering about the very bad jokes we're making, White Wolf Mage, second edition. Because third edition got a little weird, and then the remakes got very weird. Anyways, symbols carry an undeniable power, whether it's the Ankh, the crucifix, or the golden arches of McDonald's. For thousands of years, runes, glyphs, and icons have been used in occult rituals that spiritual practices to mess with reality. Today, drawings imbued with the desires of their creators, called sigils, are undergoing a resurgence. Advocates insist that they really work, and a new app called the Sigil Engine automates the whole process, aiming to make inventing reality even more accessible. I kind of want to download this app, not to use for sigils, but because you could probably make some really cool website logos with this thing. Rat says he's lost. I think most of us were lost in the fact that people have taken their D&D spells and they're trying to make them real on the internet with an app.
I am homesick for a place that doesn't exist anymore, Morps. Just kill me.
I'm going to cast Featherfall using my smartphone and then jump off the Empire State Building.
Fuck you, Harry Potter motherfuckers.
Hey, that's a D&D reference, you cockback.
I don't give a fuck. Fucking wizardry faggots. Get the fuck out.
I want to cast Magic Missile at the darkness, but I can't find my flashlight app. Morps, can I have a Mountain Dew?
Damn it.
The correct response is yes, just go get it. Now.
Are there any chicks there? Oh.
Well, this has been your weekly level of faggotry. Tune in again next week.
I'll be honest with you. I'm kind of retarded.
There you go.
Now that we've got to the humorous stories, I did find something funny that I'm kind of happy about that got snuck into the COVID-19 legislation. if it passes.
That's got to be more interesting than me talking about these
another 30 billion for Israel.
Internet
right?
sigils.
No. As part of the newly passed COVID-19 relief legislation, lawmakers are demanding answers from U.S. intelligence agencies and defense departments on the potential existence of UFOs and other unidentified aerial phenomenon. So someone snuck into the $2.3 trillion bill. The Army has to tell us about aliens.
And as the great American experience draws to a close, it goes out with a whimper.
Well, I'm not going to read the rest of the Vice article because it's kind of long and it tries to explain sigils and how
and
some of this
Vice.
Stuff works.
And it's Vice. Vice.
But I will point out at the bottom, the next article linked to it is witches are trying to figure out whose spell gave Trump COVID-19.
Everyone knows it was the hacker 4chan using Q. Come on.
Oh, no, it was the four Russian prostitutes he was banging in the Oval
Shut
Office.
Shut up,
Play the racist music.
Those for COVID.
Play the racist music. Let's go.
I got two things for you tonight in Digital Dojo, besides it being racist music. Neither of which involves sigils or giving Trump COVID-19 via witchcraft. The first is actually a full write-up from Christian Hashtag's blog about how he heats his entire house by crypto mining.
Don't let Greta find out.
Actually, apparently it's more efficient than his old heater.
Then his old heater was really fucked.
So he's got a full write-up here explaining how it works, explaining what crypto mining is, showing his GPU rigs, and how he's basically ducted them into the house to use the crypto miners to heat his home rather than running his heater.
What's he going to do when summer rolls around?
Probably unduct all this crap and turn his air conditioner back on like a sane person. So, yeah, he's got some stuff in here. Apparently, by the way, this guy's in Australia.
What? No one needs to heat their home here.
What about in the southern coast near the pole? I don't know how near the pole it is, but surely it's in the temperate zone.
I don't know. Where does this guy live?
If
it's not Tasmania, he's fucking lunatic.
He doesn't actually say. He just says...
I bet you he's Victorian.
He's just referencing Australia when he's talking about the laws for taxes on this stuff.
And like, if anything, he's going to run his crypto mining heating system for like 1 month a year, if that, if he lives in a real cold southern state.
This is reminding me of University of Nevada when they found all of those Commodore 64s. They used them to heat a building.
Yeah, but they also had the equivalent processing power of a Pentium 4, and they were able to run Windows XP on it.
Yep. And heat a building.
Oh, yeah. Are you you may not know that story, because this is an ancient story. So there was university. I think it was, what did you say it was, Madman? Arizona?
I thought it was Nevada.
Oh, it might have been Nevada. It was a Midwestern state. Apparently, they had bought like 1,000 Commodore 64s with the intention to put them in their labs.
They bought their entire freshman class of the year Commodore came out of Commodore 64.
And never distributed them or used them. They ended up in storage. And then in the mid-2000s, they found them. And they're like, well, nobody's going to do anything with these. So they developed a cluster computer off of them and got about the equivalent processing of a Pentium 4. And they were able to run, they said it would run XP across the distributed platform, but it was not terribly usable because so much of it was dependent on communication speeds.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah, it was cool. It was a cool read. I'd have to find the article again. That was a long time ago when I found that. I remember thinking it was awesome.
It was on Decking. We discussed it.
Did we?
Yep.
Oh, I'd have to dig through my notes and find it. Anyways, the last thing I have for tonight is a interesting little tool called Trader. Trader is written in Go and is a tool that takes advantage of as many root escalations as the guy who wrote it could think of, including things like vulnerable binaries. He goes through the GTFO bins, and he's adding more root escalations to it. And it's a little tool that you put on a machine. The idea is after you've compromised a machine, you're likely not going to be root. You're probably going to be, say, the www account or the Apache account or whatever service you popped, or, you know, you've guessed a password for some user and you're not root on that system. Well, this is a little binary that you can run it, and it's going to go through everything it knows how to do and try to get you a root shell. You know, vulnerable Docker containers, bad processes. He's adding more to it. And he even has instructions on the README that if you can't seem to get the data onto the machine any other way, of how to copy and paste it into the terminal by Base64 encoding the binary. Now, this is fucking cool because it's a root escalation binary for Unix, for Linux, that will give you, you know, root on any system you can get it on that has vulnerabilities. This is also a try-them-all script kiddie tool. So if you're going to use a tool like this, you need to be aware it's not subtle. You are putting a binary on a system that you've compromised and using it to get a root shell that's going to sit there and try things until it gets it. So this is the... this is the network security equivalent of kicking in the front door and pointing your automatic weapon at the frightened people who you've just home invaded.
And
versus sneaking in the
back. How many people are keeping an eye on their locks?
Well, that's why things like this work. But I'm pointing this out because if your intention is to sneak into a system and not leave a trace that you were there, this is not your tool. But if you don't fucking care, you just want to get root on the box and call it a day, this might be your tool. And it's just something to think about when you have tools like this, because this is absolutely a script kiddie tool. But at the same time, it could be a useful script kiddie tool. So, you know, something to think about with things like this. And I kind of like that philosophy of, do you use a tool that's like kicking in the front door, or do you use a tool that's like sneaking in the back? Because much like running nmap from your machine on the box and hitting all ports aggressively scanning, is this sort of, you know, really trying to shake the door off the hinges, if the nmap case, this is putting a binary on a box and using it to get a root shell. Kind of obvious. Sort of like the old autopwn script in Metasploit. I mean, it might work, but you might crash a box doing it too, because it's not quiet, it's not subtle. But it works in many cases. You know, his example is using Docker to do it. But, yeah. So, if nothing else, it'd be an interesting tool to load up on your own Linux systems to see if they're vulnerable to it. Because it'll tell you what it used to get you that root shell, so then you could possibly go fix it. So you could at least argue it has a security point other than just flat out breaking things. So... anyways, that's all I've got for tonight. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Peer decking every Thursday. The Galaxy 15 radio site, the subreddit, in the IRC tonight. Myself, Sardonyx, Cyber Dystopia, Cyber Lard, DP View, Herats, Madman, Striker26, and the Coffee Maker with an underscore after it. And Rats wants to recommend a good tech podcast to everyone. So by the time he hears this, we'll probably be done with Madman. Closing thoughts.
Oh, well, I kind of blew mine with the, we're going to find out about aliens due to the COVID-19 relief bill and other random shit.
All right, Madman's already shot his wad. Are you? Closing thoughts.
I really want to go magnet fishing. I've just been watching this video for the last couple of minutes. All the guns this dude is getting. Holy shit. Yeah, it looks like I'm going magnet fishing this weekend, boys.
So are you just going to come back on? So I found a bunch of wrecked piping, and Nails. Did you find any guns? No. I was watching one where some dude was magnet fishing off a boat dock, and he kept pulling up, you know, metal piping. And then finally he pulled up this huge framework which matched the side of the dock. And then he asked some guy he was with, and they said, oh, yeah, there was a storm last year, and they lost part of the dock and had to come out and replace it. So he had pulled up the part of the dock that had gotten blown off. Of it. So let's see. Her Rats wants to recommend broken silicone. Mostly gaming PC hardware, good interviews with, like, NAND memory engineers and stuff. So, okay. Also called Moore's Law is Dead on YouTube. Why are we recommending other podcasts?
Yeah, I think he was wanting us to check it out.
Oh, okay. Gaming PC hardware. I mean, it kind of sounds like, you know, a podcast equivalent of Linus Tech Tips, but, Oh, yeah, he wants us to look at it. He didn't want... Okay.
More people in the pond, the better, you know?
That's
more
true.
Shows, the better,
I think. That's true.
I have no problem with if someone says, hey, that show's good, go check it out, and pumping it out.
Oh, he does interviews with server engineers and looks at the logs. Okay, I misunderstood you. I was thinking it was, you know, all gaming PC stuff, and I'm like, well, I mean, it's fun. I'm not going to deny that.
I was thinking it was something like G4 when it was still good.
All right. I got nothing else. Anybody have anything, or do I need to just hit the sound effects?
Hit the sound effects.
Sound effects.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Now let's go nose down and call it a night.
Shut up, Wesley. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm kind of retarded.